numbers 215871 and 215872, the United States of America versus Marquise Tompkins, oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Eggert for the appellant.
May it please the court, I would request 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Counsel. Very good.
Marquise Tompkins was sentenced to 312 months in prison after a fundamentally unfair trial. Mr. Tompkins was convicted of conspiring with Justin Sampley in a drug conspiracy. He was found guilty of 5 controlled buys with Mr. Sampley, who was a governmental informant. And finally, he was convicted of felon in possession of a gun. We assert multiple errors here, but I want to start with the failure to sever the felon in possession. Here, that count was count 8, was misjoined. The gun was found in Mr. Tompkins' vehicle on August 23rd, 2020. The gun had no connection with the drug conspiracy or the substantive underlying drug distribution charges. And that's not just my argument. That's the government's admitted that in his brief. It said the gun was unconnected to Mr. Tompkins' alleged illegal drug activities. So you have an unconnected, unrelated gun, which formed count 8, that count of the indictment. Now, under Rule 8...
Your client didn't object to the joinder in the district court, did he?
No, but at the same time, we believe that this error is plain. It's not harmless. It affected his substantial rights. And because there's a misjoinder, the burden is on the government to show that that error was harmless. Because if there's misjoinder, and there was, there's no discretion on the part of the court.
The jury's not stupid. I mean, the jury was told when the gun was discovered and under what circumstances. The court told the jury to consider each count separately. Now, why should we assume that they didn't do that? I mean, the assumption would seem to be that they did.
Well, a couple of things here. First of all, the period of the conspiracy went to August 23rd when they found the gun. So someone could easily, I think a jury would be inclined to infer that the gun was related to the conspiracy. In addition, there was no limiting instruction on this gun.
What harm if they did think it was connected to the conspiracy? Because the conspiracy was not an element of the gun offense.
Right.
I mean, he's charged with being a felon in possession. And so they don't even need to be concerned one way or another with the conspiracy when they're considering that charge.
Except they've been told, one, he's a felon. That's how the case begins.
Well, everybody who's charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm is a felon. I mean,
that's true, but it should be. That's why the count should be severed.
And
that's,
we don't normally charge. I mean, it's not common to sever those counts, is it? Do you? It's not the normal practice.
Actually, though, but to go back, that count was misjoined. It shouldn't have even been on that indictment. That's the problem there. It's different than saying they were properly joined, but there's prejudice. We believe there was prejudice.
What you seem to be saying is that because being a felon is an element of felon in possession, that you can't join that with a drug count.
I think you can if they're related, but in this case, they agree that they're not related. This was just a flat misjoinder to begin with. If, in fact, he had a gun during the buys, maybe they could have been joined. And with proper limiting instructions. But that's not the facts here. The facts is the gun is unrelated to the drug counts, and the government so says. So you start with a misjoinder, and that's the problem in this case. It started with a misjoinder, and since it's a misjoinder, it shouldn't have been part of that indictment and shouldn't have been part of this trial. And as I understand it, there's misjoinder, then the government has to show the error was harmless. And there's no doubt it's not discretionary. It's not under Rule 8A. It was not part of a common scheme or plan. It was not a similar act. It was not part of a similar events. It was plain, flat out wrong to join that in the trial. It was misjoinder.
Well, you don't disagree that harmless error applies in this conceptually here, do you?
Well, I think I've got to admit conceptually it does, but not in this case because the evidence.
So if we put aside for just a second whose burden it is on establishing harmless error, all you seem to make here is he's a bad man argument. That's what I distill your argument to be. Because they heard about a gun and he was in the vicinity of a shooting, therefore he's a bad man, therefore he's guilty of the drug offense. That's basically your argument, isn't it?
No. What we're saying is that all that, yes, is highly prejudicial, and we think that it infected the case. But to go back, this was not an overwhelming case, to say the least. I mean, it was rested on two drug addict informants who were working off criminal charges, Sampley and Russell Price. That was really their case. There was video and audio, but really only a side view. And no identification. They didn't. No law enforcement officer saw the transactions. No drugs were recovered from Tompkins. It was a weak case. We would respectfully submit, and this tipped the scales. This gun shooting felon evidence that had nothing to do with it. In addition,
I guess my problem with your argument is I just don't see any connection looking at the record as a whole between the gun charge and the drug charge. And I know that's what your argument is.
Yes.
But as the case went in, it seemed like they went in almost compartmentalized. This is the drug count. This is the gun count. I just don't see the overlap in any of the arguments or theories that were being presented that would be confusing to the jury.
Well, the gun charge was on the last day of the indictment. Okay, the indictment extended to that day they found the gun, August 23rd, and the government alleged that conspiracy in a superseding indictment. In addition, we would point out this: the way they prove the felony exacerbated the prejudice. They put on his probation officer. And his probation officer, defense counsel did offer to stipulate he's a felon, gun was found in his car, the search was lawful. Nonetheless, the government was permitted, despite that offer, to put on evidence of the mall shooting, then put on evidence that he was on federal supervised release and had been convicted of a felony. This federal supervised release had nothing to do with any of the elements of the case, and that, coupled with he's a felon, is highly, highly prejudicial. He's done it again, many jurors would think. He's been in trouble before. He's on probation right now. He wasn't following the rules. And they shouldn't have tried them together, but then to prove the case that way added to the prejudice that we think shows that it's not harmless. It was serious effort, and I don't see how they can justify showing that he's on federal supervised release, that he's on probation. That is really prejudicial to any defendant. And so, you know, we think that, as I said, contaminated the case from the beginning and continued to contaminate it when they said his probation officer testified. We would also argue there were additional problems with the instructions in this case, and that goes to the conspiracy count. They charge a conspiracy count, and in the instructions, they didn't say you couldn't conspire with a governmental agent. And that clearly confused the jury because they had a question. On those first five buys, there's no doubt he's a governmental agent, and we would submit he was a governmental agent throughout.
Why wasn't that cleared up in answer to the question?
Well, I think the answer was they had two questions, and the answer was, you know, can he be a co-conspirator? All the court said was no. The court didn't elaborate at all. And in that Nunes case, which we cited, there was a supplemental instruction. They should have been told a governmental agent cannot be a co-conspirator. The second thing, Your Honor, Justice, is that they were given no guidance on how to determine whether he continued to be a governmental agent or not. And we submit the fact is he was a governmental agent throughout. Even after the buys, he met with police, he updated with police, he was making identifications, looking at pictures, he testified at trial. He never stopped being a governmental agent. And he tells the authorities, hey, I'm buying drugs. He was all over the place, but I'm buying drugs 30 or 40 times from Tompkins. He told them that with impunity because he wasn't going to be charged.
Did you try the case?
No, sir, I did not.
Did the lawyer that tried the case include in closing argument or at some point during the trial, did the lawyer argue to the jury that you can't be guilty of conspiring with somebody who's a government agent?
Judge, I don't know if the defense counsel did. The government said that. And I'd simply say, though, the government's arguments are not a substitute for the instructions.
Well, but the government said that, plus the judge told him that, not in the instructions, but in response to a question, correct?
He just said one word, no. He didn't elaborate on that, and he didn't give him, as I said, any kind of way to determine whether he continued to be a governmental agent. One could take from that answer, no, and think for this period, he couldn't be conspiring.
Was the defense theory at trial that he continued to be a governmental agent?
Well, I think the defense argued that in its directed verdict. I think the defense, though, was saying that Tompkins was not guilty, was not the person. But I don't think the defense theory means that the judge shouldn't have said you cannot be a co-conspirator with a governmental agent.
So the defendant didn't choose to defend against the buys that were not controlled buys by saying that whatever his name was continuing to work with the government.
No, Judge, I think that he made a motion for directed verdict, so legally he argued that he continued to be a conspirator. But his defense at trial wasn't Tompkins was there, but this man wasn't. He didn't say Tompkins was there, but it wasn't really a conspiracy. And then the controlled buys, of course, that wouldn't have been defense of the controlled buys because it would have been defense of the conspiracy, but not to the buys themselves.
That's true.
Yeah, so he certainly didn't say, hey, I was there. Yes.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right. So, no, and I did not try the case. But I would respectfully submit that the counsel did offer that stipulation. That stipulation should have kept all that evidence out, and the evidence about a felon never should have been in there to begin with. In addition, problems.
Well, you can wind up. I know you're out of time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. I finally would say, yes, he shouldn't have been convicted of that conspiracy. And finally, there are additional instructions we believe should have been given. Specifically, these were addicts. He didn't get an instruction on that. They also were working off criminal charges, didn't get an instruction on that. And we don't think there should have been instruction on the right to remain silent. We think that was double-barrel prejudice with the fact that they got in that he's a felon. So all in all, we believe he was denied a fair trial and that warrants reversal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Ross Goldman for the United States. I'll begin with the misjoinder claim. As we outlined in our brief, there are a couple of reasons why he can't show reversible plain error here. One is, He has cited no case from this court, the Supreme Court, or any court showing that the district court should have sua sponte severed the 922G count from the drug counts. And we know from this court's decision in Al-Maliki and others that the failure to cite binding precedent essentially forecloses a finding by this court that any error was clear and obvious rather than subject to reasonable dispute. Second,
you have a case that presents facts such as these that where the court ruled against a defendant on this issue of the severing of the counts?
Well, I mean, most of the cases are cases where there is some connection between the counts such that joinder claim, Rule 8 joinder claims are rejected. The one case that standing here right now comes to my mind where this court found a misjoinder problem is Chavis, where there were two substantive counts that were separated by a roughly two-year period. One count was making false statements in connection with the purchase of a gun. The second count was possession of a gun. And the second count was a drug trafficking count. And this court said that there was misjoinder, but that any error was harmless.
Do you at least concede that these counts are unrelated?
So I wouldn't concede that. I would concede that the top line question of whether there was misjoinder here is, as this court said in the Cody case, is reasonably debatable, and here's why. The Rule 8 inquiry is determined based on the allegations on the face of the indictment. Looking at the face of the indictment, on the one hand, there is nothing in count 8, the felon in possession charge, that suggests that the gun was possessed in furtherance of or in connection with any kind of drug activity. And similarly, in the drug counts, there's no allegation there that a gun was possessed or used. And so from that perspective, that may counsel against a finding of joinder. On the other hand, the counts are temporally related, which was an important fact in Chavis, where they were not. Insofar as here, the charged gun possession was on the last day of the charged drug conspiracy, this court also recognized in Chavis that where you have sort of temporal connection and the sort of intuitive idea that guns and drugs kind of go together, that may have been enough. But I would not certainly dispute the idea that the top line question is reasonably debatable. I think the easiest thing for this court might be to do what the court did in Cody, which is not to resolve the top line question of whether there was error and proceed simply to hold that there was no prejudice. And on the prejudice inquiry, I just want to say, because this claim is unpreserved, the burden is on the defendant to show an effect on his substantial rights. The cases in which this court applies harmless error review to misjoinder claims are claims where the claim is preserved. Any other holding would be, I think, an unprecedented deviation from what is by now well-established, well-entrenched plain error law, which places the burden to show an effect on substantial rights on the defendant. In this case, he can't discharge that burden. Indeed, even if the burden were ours, he would not be entitled to relief. And that's true for a couple of reasons. First, and I think most prominently, the district court in this case instructed the jury that there were several counts, that the jury is required to consider the evidence in the counts separately, and that the jury's verdict on any one count should not influence the jury's verdict on any other count. This is, in every material respect, identical to the instructions that this court held in both Cody and Chavis were sufficient to overcome any prejudice that may have flowed from improperly joined counts. Second, the jury acquitted on count 7, and this court has recognized, the Supreme Court has recognized in Young, that where the issue is whether something happened created some kind of prejudice insofar as it tainted the jury verdict, an acquittal is powerful evidence, in fact, that the jury was not tainted, that there was no prejudice, that the jury was and remained able to fairly discharge its obligations. Third, the evidence on the 922G count, it would have been, as it was in Cody, easy to compartmentalize for the jury. The evidence that came in with respect to 922G was simply that he was the victim of a shooting at the mall, an innocent victim of a shooting. His car was towed, searched the following day, and a loaded firearm was found underneath the driver's seat of his car. That's it. There was no effort by the government, or either through argument or through the elicitation of testimony from witnesses, to link up or otherwise try to connect those counts in any sort of substantive way. And I think that further emphasizes the extent to which there's no effect, or that Mr. Tompkins can't show an effect on his substantial rights. If there's no questions on misjoinder, I do want to talk about the instructional issue with respect to Mr. Stampley's status as a co-conspirator. The evidence in this case, both from the testimony of Justin Stampley and from Detective Perdue, was clear several times over that after the last of the controlled buys on March 18th, 2020, Mr. Stampley stopped working as a confidential informant for Detective Perdue. That's largely, the record shows, I think, due to COVID and the consequences of COVID having shut down investigations. Mr. Stampley testified that he then went upwards of 30 or 40 times on his own to go buy drugs for Mr. Tompkins. In that role, he was operating as a middleman, he testified. Indeed, Detective Perdue testified that the first time he knew that Sampley had bought any drugs from Mr. Tompkins after the fifth controlled buy was roughly 5 months later in August of 2020. And so from that perspective, the evidence was clear, and everyone understood. Well, let me put it this way. The government argued to the jury in its closing argument with respect to count one, do not convict on count one on the basis of Mr. Sampley in his during the controlled buys in his role as an informant. But proceeded to argue, but you should convict. The evidence was sufficient to prove after he stopped working as an informant. That's when the relevant conspiratorial agreement was reached. And indeed, the jury asked a question about this in jury deliberations, and the district court correctly answered that question when the court said no in response to the question, could Justin Sampley have been a co-conspirator for the period February 21st through March 18th, 2020? And indeed, on appeal now, Mr. Tompkins says that that instruction was confusing or misleading or somehow insufficient. That's not what he said in the district court. In the district court, his top line position was actually the district court didn't need to say anything at all because the government had made the point clear in its closing argument. After the district court discussed its proposed response with the parties, Mr. Tompkins and the government both explicitly stated on the record that it had no objection to the way in which the district court answered that question, which again was a correct statement of the law and would have, I think, fully resolved any confusion that the jury may have had and would have fully protected Mr. Tompkins' right not to be convicted of a conspiracy based on an agreement with someone who at the time was operating as a confidential informant. I'm happy to address any other questions on either of these issues or any other issue in the case if the court has them. If not, we would rest on our briefs and we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Several points. In Chavis, the court found a misjoinder. The idea that there's a gun, Chavis specifically rejected the idea that just because there's a drug count and a gun count, they can be tried together. And in fact, they found misjoinder. In Chavis, what they found was harmless error. And indeed, there was harmless error in Chavis because the defendant admitted guilt as to one of the counts. And that also is true as Cody. So there's in both those cases, there was overwhelming evidence. Second, I think the government's position supports what we're saying about prejudice. They're arguing, well, they can be joined because maybe they can be joined because drugs and guns go together. That's exactly what we fear the jury thought. Exactly what we fear the jury thought, and that's what they just argued. In addition, when they talk about the instructions being clear, the answer, as I said, was no, but then there was no supplemental instruction. Sampley kept buying, told police all about it, because he was still working for him. Kept the detective updated, testified at trial, said he was going to get his charges dismissed. He never stopped being a governmental agent. Never.
So have you found any cases where this sort of unusual conflux, I think, of facts here, where it's not requested by the defense counsel, the defense counsel then agrees with the instructions and agrees with the answer? I mean, at what point how would we draw the line where we say that under facts like this, the judge should have stepped in and sua sponte did something that you're claiming he failed to do in this case?
Yes, sir. I would say Griffin is analogous, and that's where the court said sua sponte, there should have been an instruction regarding an addict. And I think there was plain error. But beyond that, Your Honor, one thing that was clearly should have been done and was not, this generic instruction, consider each count. The jury should have been told that fact of a felony, obviously it wouldn't prejudice the felon in possession count, that's how you prove it, but our point is it would prejudice the other counts. They should have been told that status of felony can be considered only for that count and no other reason. And There is an instruction in this case talking about limiting felony convictions and prior records. And it was given for the informants because they had prior records. So they got a limiting instruction, but the appellant who's on trial never got it from the court. And finally, I think it'd be very hard to compartmentalize a felony, and the jury can always consider evidence as to each count, but can consider the whole case. And when they consider the whole case, they consider he's a felon with a gun on supervised release to these unrelated drug counts. Thank you.
Thank you. And the case is submitted.